Rinpoche's CD-ROM transcription work. You don't have to finish it before the exam. You're getting it so late, so due to my slowness. So, but you won't get your exam back. That's flattening.
Oh, we'd never get our exams back. We got 6 months.
And there'll be Monday and Tuesday. There'll be a package standing out. Okay. If you can't, if you absolutely can't use the computer, we know who you are. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, about the cheese.
Tell me. I'd like to say how I understand it, and you tell me if I got it.
Okay.
As I understand it, this is four different ways that we perceive things as self-existent and progressive. Four different ways that the mind conceives, perceives, whatever.
The Tsokchi is not really. It's not the main. Tsokchi is very minor.
But I'm saying these are four. The mind works in these four different ways of perceiving and identifying and imaging. Right? Yeah. Is that the idea?
You could say that, but also. You could outline it like this, you know, that first there's the collect, the whole and the parts one.
Right.
You know what I mean? Is Chevrolet a whole? Is cars a whole and Chevrolet is a part?
No.
No. Okay, so that's not the main one. Whole and whole and part one is not really the. It's a chi, but it's not the chi one. That if you perceive it perfectly, you'll understand the culture. That's not the one. It's not the main one. But it's helpful, right? And it's the one that most people who teach emptiness talk about. It's helpful, but it's not the main one. What's the other one?
Rinpoche.
Yeah, the other is the, you could call it the type, the general. The type general? What did I call it?
Type.
And then that's, I mean, I don't want you to think of them as four different ones. I would put number three and number four under here. You see? And that you just got to think about. You have to think about it. It's very difficult. And that's the whole trick. That other thing, the Dachi and the Jinji, the sound, you know, the word general. What do you want to call that? How about idealization from a word, from words,
right?
And then idealizations from. I didn't mean to say there were four types that were all equally. I would put these two under number two. And that you've got to think about.
The way I was thinking of this was that, number one, you know, you look at something and you see its parts and you assemble its parts into a conceptual whole in your mind, right?
That's good.
An idealized whole in your mind.
Yeah.
And the second one, it's like you take everything that exists and you break it down in your mind into categories and subcomponents. It's like working the opposite way of number one, like you're taking the universe and creating categories and groupings and.
But how is that done? Do you do that consciously when you're a kid?
Is that what it means that you
yeah,
do that?
Yeah, it means that, but it's instinctual. It's what you would call instinctual, which is really ignorance at work.
So
and that's very subtle.
So you do that, and then the way in which you do it is through three and four. Is that the point?
No. That's just ways of recognizing specific cases of doing this.
Right. So the point is those are the two different ways you do that.
Yeah. Mostly Jinji.
And this is happening simultaneously.
No, they. You could not have a Dachi all day. I mean, if people only talk to you about things that you've had experience of. Most of the time, when I use language, every word I use is something you have an experience of. For you, it's a Jinji. But the other one, Dachi, is more theoretical. It's like if I, you know, how to use a certain spreadsheet in a computer, you know. You know somebody doing it, and it's a Dachi, but you don't personally have any experience how to do that.
That's why those words that you use are confusing for me, because I thought that the Dachi was that mental image that you get when someone says something to you that's based on a prior direct perception. So you think it's a prior direct perception.
Well, that's true, too.
And then the other one was about something that you had a mental image from some other.
Yeah, based on. They're both. They can both occur as a result of someone saying a word. If I say John Stilwell's face, you can't see it right now. Something comes into your mind, you've seen it before. That's a dunchi, yeah. And then a dachi would be. A sound, a word one would be, you know, like Taj Mahal if you've never seen Taj Mahal.
Were those reversed?
No.
Three is. Drachi and four is Dunchi, the way you
this is Drachi and this is Dunchi, yeah.
Oh, okay.
There's no particular order. Drachi is often, yeah, last time I talked to you.
So if I understand you correctly, then you're saying that the way in which we take everything that exists in the universe and break it down into whatever categories that
whatever
we come up
with. Whatever your karma demands it to break it down.
It's through the process of, or through the technique of number three and number four,
yeah.
Idealizing through words and through experiences.
Yeah, which are particular examples of number two.
Okay.
Particular cases of number two. You really have to think about that. You wouldn't think offhand that they are the same as Chevrolet and car. And you have to think about it.
So this is about that we're not really getting some direct thing. We're creating that image in our head.
Yeah. There's no reality outside that demands that be the idealization that you have. There's nothing coming from the object side that demands that you idealize it in that particular way. It's reasonable that you do, given your data, and that's why we call it semi-valid perception, in Uma, in Vajimita Prasadita. But from the object's own side, there's nothing that requires you to label it a certain way. That comes from you. And that you just have to cook it. It's a deep, it's very important. It's really important. Think about cars and Chevrolet. Okay? Okay. What's it say, Dachomba? Okay. Dachomba. Dha means what? Enemy. And Chomba means destroyer. So Dachomba is a
enemy destroyer.
A foe destroyer or an arhat.
Mm-hmm.
The Sanskrit word is arhat. The Sanskrit root arh means to be worthy. To be worthy or deserving. And so sometimes when the Tibetans etymologize it, they say, Dachomba, he destroys the foe of the mental affliction. And then they say, therefore he's worthy of prostrations of the entire world. And you miss it if you don't know Sanskrit. It's a pun. The word arhat is a pun. One of the roots means to kill, to slay. One of the roots means worthy. And you miss it if in the Tibetan translations. And then later Tibetan writers maybe didn't even know it. So they just copied the what the earlier writers said. So Dachomba means arhat. If Dha is the enemy, right? Mental afflictions, your mental afflictions. So reaching Dachomba, arhat, foe destroyer, and reaching what are simultaneous? Nirvana and destruction of the destruction of your mental afflictions. Nirvana and destroying your mental afflictions permanently are synonyms. Yeah.
And for Mahayana Bodhisattvas, it would be Buddhahood.
We're going to talk about it. Generally, they say that. Generally, that's what you say. Generally, it's presented as if you reach Nirvana with Bodhicitta in your heart, then that's enlightenment. If you reach Nirvana without Bodhicitta in your heart, that's a Hinayana Nirvana. And then you've still got, that's called the extreme of peace, and you've still got a ways to go. Yeah.
So this refers to both kinds of arhats?
It's very subtle.
That's when you have to get the first kind of
renunciation. We're talking about it. Okay, so that's a Dachomba. And if when you read the reading, the Diamond Sutra at this point, the Diamond Cutter Sutra reaches a point here where the Buddha basically asks the Bodhi, is a Dachomba a Dachomba? Is an arhat an arhat? And so Bodhi answers, if an arhat thinks to himself, I'm an arhat, then he's
not
an arhat. Okay. All right? If an arhat thinks to himself, hey, I finally reached arhat, then he's not an arhat. And then Subhuti says, for example, if someone reached the eighth bodhisattva bhumi, eighth bodhisattva level, okay, that's very important to me.
Is that the last one?
No, there's 10.
Okay.
There's 10 bodhisattva levels. When do you reach the first bodhisattva level? She's half right. She said when you reach the Pathasini. What did she mean out? Yeah, if you reach the path of seeing on the Bodhisattva track, there's three tracks, right? Two Hinayana tracks and one Mahayana track. If you're on the Mahayana track, meaning you already have Bodhicitta. By the way, the minute you get Bodhicitta, you're on the Mahayana track. You can go halfway through the Hinayana track and jump up to the Mahayana track. They say that's a waste of time. They say you might as well go to the Mahayana track right away. Sooner or later, you got to go up there. There's a flow chart. Okay.
We're waiting.
And it's very complicated. It's called Genda Nishupa, the 20 permutations. And we have to learn the whole thing. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, at some point, you got to jump up to this Bodhisattva track. And when you get first path is when you reach Bodhicitta. Second path is intellectual understandings of emptiness under the influence of Bodhicitta. Third path is direct perception of emptiness under the influence of Bodhicitta. Path of seeing for Bodhisattva. That is the first Bodhisattva level. So two things happen at the same time. You see emptiness directly as a Bodhisattva. You're already a Bodhisattva. You see emptiness directly. At that same moment, you reach the first Bodhisattva level. So reaching the first Bodhisattva level is a big deal. It happens at the same moment that you perceive emptiness directly, already having Bodhicitta in your mind. So eight Bodhisattva levels, woo. You know, that's really far. That's really far along. Where do you think the eighth Bodhisattva level relates to the five paths? Yeah, it's in number four. Because number three, you saw emptiness directly. Number five, you're already a Buddha. Number four has got a lot of work in there. You've got a lot of things to do in number four. So eighth Bodhisattva level occurs when you've already reached the fourth path. Okay. Very high. Very high. By the time of the eighth Bodhisattva level, you reach a special level called... It's a very complicated thing. Nobody knows what it means. You can look it up in a computer. You can go through 50,000 pages of scripture. It'll only stop once or twice. But it's important. It means by the time of the eighth level, your perceptions are no longer polluted by ignorance. They're no longer affected by ignorance. You still have the subtle seeds for that ignorance in your mind. And when you get rid of those, you become a Buddha. But by this point, your mind is no longer influenced by ignorant, plain ignorance. I'm not talking about its seeds. The name of the eighth level? It's just called Earth Number Eight. That's why sometimes they call them Bodhisattva Grounds. So mastery here, which is actually the Tibetan word for patience, and a lot of people mistranslate that, it can mean mastery also. These things that will never grow can refer to two things. One is emptiness. Okay. One is all the emptinesses in the world. And one refers to your mental afflictions. Basically, you've overcome your mental afflictions at that point. There's a very subtle argument about it, but basically you've overcome your mental afflictions. So you are very similar to lower arhats. So what you've achieved at by the eighth level and what they've achieved at the end of their five paths is very similar. Yeah, in the sense of being an arhat, like Bodhisattva. Okay, do they call you an arhat at that point? I'm still studying, okay? I don't think so. I believe a Bodhisattva arhat would have to be a Buddha, but I'm still checking out. Okay, you basically achieve a state very similar to a lower by that point, because you have overcome your ignorance. Overcoming ignorance has big implications with overcoming what? Mental afflictions, yeah. Okay? When you have finished your ignorance, you won't be able to have what? Mental afflictions anymore. Okay, that's the whole subject of the course tonight. The class tonight. Okay, we're going to talk about the relationship between getting rid of your bad thoughts, your six favorite ones. Okay, pride, jealousy, anger, hatred, ignorance, whatever you like that, and getting rid of those six permanently, and not seeing things as self-existent anymore. What's the relationship between those two? Yeah.
Is it when you say seeds for ignorance? Is seeds.
Bhakcha, mental seed.
But then that implies
that something would grow from that. That's the second reason why they call this never grow. It's called Mauma Makirichicha. It means a future thing that will never happen. Okay? Your kleshas become a thing, which there are seeds for them, but those seeds will never ripen. They become things of the future that will never occur. They become like, okay, suppose I have a lot of seeds for apple trees, but I can't get them out of this room before they rot. Then they are seeds for a future thing which will never happen. They are, you can call them seeds, but they're never going to have any results. And there's a beautiful argument on that. That's another story. Nominally speaking, if they don't have results, they can't be called seeds. So you picked up on that. So that things that will never grow really has two senses. One is emptiness, because it never grows because why? It's an uncaused object. It's a negative object. Emptiness is an absence. Nothing can cause emptiness. Emptiness, one meaning of things that will never grow, one meaning, the first meaning of two, is emptinesses. All the emptinesses in the universe, actually. They will never grow, they never did grow. They have no causes. You can't grow a new emptiness. Why? It's very, very subtle. You will perceive this fact directly, maybe a little bit before you see. This is the subtle meaning of impermanence. And you have to perceive that directly. That's a perception you'll have at the path of preparation. It's an important step. It's not directly related to emptiness, but the perception of subtle impermanence is itself very deep. And it won't happen to you until the path of preparation. But it means you realize that emptiness is not a thing which grows in the sense of being small and then getting bigger and then getting bigger and peaking out and then getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Emptiness goes into existence. Emptiness goes out of existence. But it doesn't grow. It's not a cause. And you gotta think about that. Yeah?
I thought the way you said it at one point, maybe in a different school, that the anarhat overcomes the mental affliction and what remains to be done is the obstruction to omniscience.
Normally.
But the bodhisattva didn't completely get rid of the mental affliction until the very last moment, and then the obstruction to omniscience and the mental affliction finished at the same time, and they were Buddhist.
The Prasangika school, and only the Prasangika school, the highest school of Buddhism, says that even the seeds of ignorance are... They say that ignorance itself is a bad thought, is a klesha. And the other schools don't say that. And so there's a big debate about it.
So which school by the school?
We're doing... Diamond Cutter Sutra is high school, Prasangika.
And what did I just
That's why I didn't say that he was totally equal to it. I said he was very similar to a lower form style. We'll leave it like that. Very complicated question. You will learn someday eight distinctive characteristics that separate the higher Madhyamika school from the lower Madhyamika school, and that's one of them. So anyway, they reach this point. When you reach that point, something neat happens.
Lung Tempa.
Lung means, do you know Lung? You know what a Lung is?
Wind.
Yeah, lung, high tone, with a ra head letter means, lung means wind, psychic wind, okay, psychic energy, whatever. It's actually what allows you, your thoughts to move. When the wind passes through certain channels in your body, you can have thoughts, conceptual thoughts, and that's a long story. But this is the low tone lung, which means the word, meaning obviously related to air and breath. The word. When you go to get a lung, meaning an oral transmission, you go to a special, it's like an initiation, and the Lama will read the Diamond Cutter Sutra. I think we'll try to get a lung from Rinpoche, okay? Of the Diamond Cutter Sutra. He just sits down, you have a big ceremony, you sit there for a long time, finally he sits down and he just reads the thing, and you just listen. And that's a transmission of the oral blessing, of the words from a living person to a living person that's passed down through the centuries. So that's a big honor to get a lung. There's people who give lungs for the whole Kangya, 3,500, 1,500 words. So it'll take like a year. And people will come every day and just sit and listen and get the oral blessing. And they won't explain what it means, they just read it out loud. That's a lung. So now you know the meaning of it. The lung is the word. Dhamma means to show, to give the word. Sometimes to give the word, lung dhamma means the Buddha declared something about something. For example, there are good deeds and bad deeds, right? And lung tempa means that the Buddha declared, oh, now this is karmically active. If you do this, something good or bad will happen. When he didn't lung tempa something, we call it karmically neutral. So if it's not lung tempa, we say the Buddha didn't specify it. He left it in that category of things like that are not karmically active. I'll give you an example, okay? Karmically active in the positive sense is lota. What's lota? Do you remember lota? Lota means shame. private shame, right? In your own room that you don't do something bad. Lota is always a virtue. It's lung dhamma. It's karmically active. It's never karmically neutral. If you have lota, like in your own room, in the privacy of your own room, you avoid a bad deed because you would feel dirty. You know, you yourself would feel embarrassed. And nobody else will ever know. That's always a virtue, according to the Abhidharma Kosha. There's two mental functions that are always virtuous. Accompany every form of virtue. And then lung dhamma, a negative way, is anger. Okay, true, uncontrolled hatred. It's never a good thing. So it's always karmically active. Lung dhamma, those are both lung dhamma. By the way, there are cases where a lama can pretend to have anger to help somebody. And there are many cases where a lama out of kindness will hit somebody on the head. It's been done to me. Lung dhamma, okay. Those are both karmically active. Sleep is karmically neutral. Okay, sleep is a mental function which is karmically neutral, according to the Abhidhamma. It can go, it can swing either way, but by itself, it's neutral. That's not lung dhamma. So lung dhamma means the word was given, meaning the Buddha specified it as karmically active. The negative of this, lung ma dhamma, didn't specify. Did you ever hear of any case where the Buddha didn't specify something or refused to specify something? Yeah. Did you ever hear of those?
He refused to specify that if God exists.
There were 14 questions. It's called Luma Denchushi that the Buddha was asked by non-Buddhist scholars in an open assembly. They posed 14 questions to him, like, is there an end to samsara, or is there no end to samsara? Does the mind have an end? Does the mind not have an end? He said, look, I can't answer you. By the way, does samsara have an end?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Yeah, that's why we're here. Does your mind have an end?
No.
Okay. Does the world have an end?
Yes.
Burned up by the sun. So those questions do have answers. But he did not give up. He didn't lung dhamma. He didn't give the word. Why? He understood that either answer he gave would be misinterpreted by those people because they would take it to be self-existent. So there are 14 questions. He just said, look, either answer I give you, you're going to misunderstand. So I won't give you any answer. That's another meaning of lung dhamma. So you got two meanings so far. One is the word was given, meaning it's karmically active. One is the word was given, meaning he did answer or he didn't answer. But what we're looking out for is number three. The third meaning of lung dhamma is the day that the Buddha comes up to you and says, okay, Lora Sigo, you decided. You will be a Buddha. Your name will be Dipamkara. You'll be on this planet, in this universe. You will appear there first. You will sit under the Bodhi tree. You will become enlightened. Congratulations. I can say it with confidence. The moment has come. That's called lung dhamma. The word, they give the word to you. It's called the final prediction. It's called the Buddha. You meet a Buddha. Something happens. You reach a certain state. And then he says, in the case of Shakyamuni, the Buddha put his foot on his head. There's a long story about it. Put his foot on the person's head that he did it, you know. I mean, Shakyamuni himself got by a Buddha named Dipankara, a former Buddha. And he reached a certain level, and then that Buddha put his foot on his head and said, now you'll become a Buddha called Shakyamuni on a planet called Earth. You'll be born in a land called India. You know, he gave him the lung dhamma. So that's the third meaning of lung dhamma.
Could you go over the second?
Second meaning of lung dhamma was to either to respond or not to respond. They called it the 14 unclarified or unspecified points. And that's where those non-Buddhist actions, you know, does the world have an end? Does samsara have an end? Does it not have an end? Does it have an end? And he said, I won't give a word. I won't say anything. That's the second meaning. But the third meaning is the one we're talking about tonight. Is when the Buddha, that day, the golden day, when the Buddha comes up to you and says, okay, you will be such and such a Buddha, such and such a Buddha. That happens when you reach the eighth Bodhisattva moment. There's a connection between reaching the eighth Bodhisattva moment and the Buddha coming up and saying, okay, you've made it. you will be such and such a Buddha.
So then this is different from the perception that he has immediately after your perception of emptiness.
It's a little bit different. They're both called illusory, illusion-like. But apparently, I can't tell you precisely, okay? I haven't studied it very well, and I don't want to, but I did read it, that at this level, apparently, you are constantly aware of the illusion.
No. I mean the prediction.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
Coming out of emptiness, you also come face to face with the Buddha who says you will...
No, he doesn't say anything. You just know.
This is more specific as well. Right?
This is where you meet a person called a Buddha, and he comes up to me. It's much later.
When and where?
Your name will be there. You will be born. You know,
you knew that already.
Yeah, you knew how many lives, and you knew that you would become a Buddha, and you knew what they wouldn't call you. Seriously, not kidding.
You're constantly perceiving relative truth.
You're constantly perceiving the discrepancy between what you think you see and what you know is there.
This level.
Yeah, but apparently it's constant by this point.
So you're seeing your own projections?
You're constantly aware that there's a discrepancy between the appearance of it to you and its reality. And the book says you perceive all emptinesses directly, or you gained a special power over that kind of perception. Apparently it's become very easy for you, or you've gained mastery over that kind of perception.
But not in meditation.
It says both. It says both. But if you were perceiving emptiness directly out of meditation, you'd be a Buddha already.
Right.
So it's...
Some intermediate.
It's like... Out, it's described in the text. You can read it in the text. He explains the word. Chöne Dhamma Sutra.
It's something that living lamas have experienced and have been able to speak about.
After you reach the first Bodhisattva Lama, you don't talk about it.
So there could be lots of people on this planet that are experiencing it, but they can't tell
us. It's not that they can't. You know that you shouldn't.
Why is that?
I know normally why you're not supposed to show miracles if you have that power. Is that although there may be a short-term influence on someone, ultimately it's not related to... They can't experience it directly themselves. And it won't really ever change them permanently. What changes people permanently and what really causes them to make spiritual progress is just plain old class time explaining things, going over things again and again. Apparently, showing someone a miracle lasts for a short time, and then it wears off. And then they go back. Then you show a second miracle. Then they need a third one shortly after that. And after a while, they're not working on a normal spiritual study. So I believe those are related, probably. You know, someone could say, "Look, I've achieved the direct perception of Jesus, and it's just like this." And then, what does it do for you? I don't think it changes you necessarily. They have to try to. And you can't believe them because you can't confirm it. So they're not supposed to... I mean, there's a thing that you're not supposed to talk about. There's a thing that if you talk about it when you didn't do it, it's one of the greatest sins you can commit. And then there's a thing where if you talk about it, the person couldn't catch it anyway, directly. So you might as well just bring them up along the causes. The cause will bring them to see it themselves. Rather do that than say, oh, hey, you know, I think it's all related to that. I don't mind if you guys don't mind to stay till 10. Okay, go ahead. Okay.
How do you know that you've achieved Bodhisattva-hood, or what's the definition of it? First level? I mean, at what point is somebody considered Bodhisattva?
It's when you get true bodhicitta, and there's two forms of bodhicitta. One is called sugarcane bodhicitta, where it tastes like bodhicitta. And it sort of feels like bodhicitta, but it comes before you achieve real bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. And then there's the perception of it. Then there's the reality of real bodhicitta. You know when you have it, and there's that physical sensation of that. And then there's, the definition is sentient tamjena mikshin. It views all sentient beings. Mm-hmm. You get a desire to achieve Buddhahood for all them. And there's it's a long definition.
You're making some extensions
on perception, actually. No, I didn't
say that. Oh, okay.
Can I ask a question about the first definition?
All right.
it wasn't clear to me. Something is karmically active. Are you saying the Buddha says it's positive or negative and that makes it active? Or in fact, it
no,
just has a result?
It's a good question. I mean, if the Buddha never mentioned it, is it automatically karmically neutral? What do you think?
No.
No. At the end of Vinaya Sutra, he says, use your common sense, apply what I said. You know, I've described 1,000 pages of good deeds and bad deeds. Now, use your common sense, you people in the future world, you know, 2,000 years from now, you'll have to use your common sense and apply these general principles to specific occurrences in your own day and time. And that one line from the Vinaya Sutra, at the end of the Vinaya Sutra, is in the monastery you study it first because it's so earth-shaking. That opens up a lot for misinterpretation. You know, you decide later, okay? I mean, that's a very dangerous thing to say. But he has to say it. He has to say, look, I couldn't cover every 84,000 bad deeds, you know. You learn what I taught, 16 volumes of bad deeds, and then you try to apply it to specific circumstances in 1995. Okay.
Some people have to leave at 9 to leave all the class right through break.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I will finish by 9. And we still have a break. That's called Pumsumba in logic. Third choice.
Okay, so quickly Third while off. You're writing, you can just say three things or something is karmically active.
Something deserves an answer. You did give an answer. And
the final position.
And it is the final. So, Subhuti, by the way, says, he says, I'm an arhat, and if I said I'm an arhat, I wouldn't have been an arhat. If I thought to myself I'm an arhat, I wouldn't be an arhat. And if I thought to myself I'm an arhat, then the Buddha would have never come up to me and said, hey, Subhuti, you're going to make it to, you find out you're going to be a Buddha. In other words, if I had ever had a grasping to self-existence, I would not have been an arhat. And obviously the Buddha would have never come up to me and said, well, congratulations, Subhuti, you're going to make it, you know. Okay, that's the whole point. That's how the Diamond Kami Sutra reaches it. Subhuti says, if an arhat thinks to himself, I'm an arhat, he's not an arhat. If an arhat thinks to himself, I'm an arhat, there's no Buddha going to come up to him and say, hey, you're going to become a Buddha at such and such a time because he couldn't have ever reached the eighth level.
So would a Buddha come up and ask, consider him Subhuti?
Long story.
Okay.
Is it wrong for an arhat to think I'm an arhat?
No, you said an arhat can't think they're an arhat, so anyone who thinks they are isn't an arhat, so
that's what the sutra says. Now, what does he mean?
Conventionally, you are who you are.
Of course you are. The Buddha looks at himself and says, I'm a Buddha. The proof of that is that it's a bad deed to steal the Buddha's begging bowl. Okay. He thinks of it as his own. If there's no his own for it to be, then there wouldn't be any bad deed of stealing the Buddha's begging bowl. That's actually the proof in logic. It means, does the Buddha think of himself as a Buddha? Of course he does. Does an arhat think of himself as an arhat? Of course he does. So if the Buddha comes up and says, Subhuti, if you think of yourself as an arhat, what does it mean? In an ultimate sense, meaning independent of your projections. That's all. That's simple. Independent of your dunchis. So that's one point. Does the person making the prediction exist? You know, if you're Subhuti, what are you going to say, Dr. Snyder? Does the person making the prediction, you know, the Buddha that comes up in tomorrow's thing, does he exist? Now you're Subhuti, you're not there.
No.
Nah. Okay, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Because if he's... I don't know.
Does he? No, does he exist? And if you say no, you mean you got to add something. He doesn't exist independent of his projections. Okay? He's projecting Buddha onto him. Okay? So the person giving the prediction, the final prediction, doesn't exist. In the sense of existing independent of his own projections. When he looks down and sees a Buddha's 112 marks, right? Does he think, oh, this is not a projection? No, he thinks, oh, I'm just projecting it on a blank screen. Great, I collected some, you know, three countless eons of karma. Now I have to see myself as a Buddha. What a dread, you know? Not like that. I mean, he understands that perfectly. He doesn't look down and say, oh, that exists out there by itself, independent of my own projections. If he ever did, he wouldn't be a Buddha. He'd be ignorant. He'd be grasping the self. So the person giving the prediction is empty. What about the person getting the prediction? Laura Siegel.
Yes.
Is she empty? Mm-hmm. Yeah, why? She doesn't exist independent of
our
projections and her own projections. And the act of that Buddha pretending I'm Buddha, and I go over and touch his hand and say, okay, Buddha. The action. You see this guy walk up, his hand goes up, his hand goes down, he says, congratulations. That whole action is what? Does it exist or not?
No,
because it doesn't exist independent of our communal projections, which also happen. Okay? There are communal projections, like New York City. Okay? So that's all. So what are those three things? Those are what you call the three elements of an action, right? The doer, the object, and the act itself are all empty. And that's what that means. Supposedly, as you do your good deeds, you're supposed to see those three emptinesses.
What's the elements?
They're the three elements of any deed. They're called the korsum, the three spheres. Or the three elements. We're calling them the three elements. The doer, the doee, and the doing. Not the do-do that my dogs do. So those are the three realms, okay, of an action. So what two things happen when you reach the eighth level? When you reach arhat. What happens when you reach arhat? Basically, you have no more mental. That's the definition. That's the definition of nirvana. I'll give you the first half. You give me the second half. Nindimalupa bangbe means you abandon permanently all the mental affliction obstacles. Soso tangok, and that is brought about by what? Soso tangok. Do you remember? It's part of the definition of nirvana. It's interesting, the definition of nirvana is not just, oh, you get rid of your mental afflictions. They actually mention the main cause of that. Sosatango. Don't you remember that?
From the individual
because
analysis.
Because you saw the four Arya truths as a result of what? Sitting emptiness and reactive. So actually in the definition of nirvana, they mention that. It's not just getting rid of your bad thoughts. And if somebody asks you, hey, what's nirvana? You shouldn't say, oh, it's just getting rid of your bad thoughts. You should say, it's getting rid of your bad thoughts permanently because you've seen emptiness directly. So there's obviously some relation between what? Seeing emptiness and getting rid of your bad thoughts. Okay. So we're beyond now class six. Class six was seeing emptiness directly. So what do you do with it? What's the use? I think a lot of teachings never get that far. They just say, oh, you should see emptiness and somehow you'll be all right. You know? Or see emptiness and go to the dentist and somehow it won't hurt. You know? And I don't like that. That's really not true. Okay?
You've been to the dentist.
You put the diamond in my tooth. And it hurts not even. I don't know what that is. Anyway, so we have to talk about what is what really goes on. The fourth path. We finished the third path. We got through that incoherently last week. now we go on to the fourth path. Okay. So this is how you achieve. This is like how do you become an arhat? What's the relationship between seeing emptiness, understanding emptiness, and getting rid of what?
Mental afflictions,
which is how you become an arhat. That's what arhat means, right? So for this, you need to know.
Did I miss something? You said two things happen when you become an arhat. You destroy your mental afflictions. Did you say the second one?
Well, there are two parts to the definition of nirvana. You destroy your mental afflictions because you saw emptiness. And specifically because you had this realization about the same. It's a weird Tibetan, okay? It's Sanskritized. Tibetanized Sanskrit. Okay? Say kalankai. Kalinga was an old area in India. Okay? It was a realm in India. Kalinkai Gyalpo. Gyalpo means king. So Kalinkai Gyalpo means the king of Kalinka. And as you read the Dharmakaya Sutra, you'll see, we'll do it this way, okay? The Buddha in a former life in India was meditating quietly in the forest, okay? And he was doing very nice, very quiet. And the queen of the local king decided to take a walk with her retinue through the forest. And she went on a long walk, picking flowers, blah, blah, blah. And she sees this meditator, and she's very struck by him, and she wonders why he's there. So she starts to have a conversation with him, and he starts to teach her the Dharma. Okay. And then they're in the middle of this Dharma conversation, and the king decides to go out hunting. So he's up on his horse with all his men, and he starts running around looking for foxes or whatever. I guess it's mongoose. No. And he comes across this monk talking to his wife. So he gets a wrong impression. And you can read it in your reading. It's page What does a king do when he's irritated with one of his subjects?
I'll put his head.
Page 7. Okay. Ariel, can you read it? The bowl at the bottom. Just read the English.
Why is it so? Because, O Subhuti, there was a time when the king of Kalinka was cutting off the larger limbs and the smaller appendages of my body. At that moment, there came into my mind no conception of a self, nor of a sentient being, nor of a living being, nor of a person. I had no conception at all. But neither did I not have any.
Okay. Pretty deep. Okay, so King of Kalinka takes this monk and ties him down on the ground and starts to slowly cut off his fingers and toes and then works up to his wrists and elbows and then finally cut his whole body to pieces. And that, I believe that saint's name was Sipama, which means person who keeps his patience. Okay, he didn't get angry. Okay. He didn't have any anger at that moment. A lot of people ask me, if you become an arhat, would you not have any pain anymore? Or, you know, if you see emptiness directly, is the point that you don't have any pain anymore? Is that directly related to not having any more pain? And then could you go to the dentist and he could just drill away and hit nerves and nothing would happen, you know? I mean, is that what emptiness is for? Or, a very common, you hear this. You know, you hear, oh, I was in the dental chair and I meditated on emptiness and nothing bothered me. You know, I made the emptiness go away into nothingness and then it didn't hurt anymore. You know, you hear that. And that we have to examine that because that's very important. If that's true, it might be really good. It might be something worth trying. Is that what it's for? Is that what happens at the path of habituation? After you see emptiness directly, is that the whole point? Do you go around trying to see things as empty and then they don't affect you anymore? They don't work the old way anymore? And they don't hurt you anymore? Is it that if the guy at work was screaming and you could dissolve him in mentally, would it not feel bad anymore to get yelled at work? Is that what we're supposed to do? And I think a lot of people go away from Buddhist books thinking, well, that's what I'm supposed to somehow see the emptiness of the situation and then it won't be happening. Is that what goes on? What did this person, that the Buddha knew that. The Buddha felt it was really important to talk about that. When he's on the subject of arhats, he starts talking about the king of Kalinka and what he himself felt. He had already perceived emptiness. He did not have any conception of his own self. Nature. And so what was going through his mind as he got his fingers and his hands cut off by his king? And we'll do that after the break. Okay, we'll take a quick break and then we'll be okay. I'm not that hungry. I'm just going to have people read and then the main point will come out in that. Okay, Fran, you ready? Page 8, first, for what reason is it so?
For what reason is it so?
sound like Pascal.
More questions.
Later. Because long ago there was a time, O Shibuti, when the king of Kalinka got the evil suspicion that I had engaged in relations with his woman, and so he was cutting off the larger limbs and smaller appendages of my body. The latter refers to the fingers and toes.
And that's Chimedaka Shibuti's thing.
At that moment I practiced patience, keeping my mind on an understanding of the lack of it, through existence to each of the three elements to the act of patience. As I focused on the me, which exists nominally, there came to my mind no conception, nor I held any belief in some truly existing me, and so I had no conception of anything from a truly existing self up to a truly existing person.
You guys remember what those four meant? I mean, they're code words in the Diamond Cutter, right? So what was it? Self means me. Sentient being means living being.
Living me is mine.
Mind. Means mine. Life means the person during his whole, during the dock, the first, the self for the course of a whole life. And the fourth one was what? It was person. And that referred to the person who's reborn and reborn and reborn. Okay. So he didn't have any one of those four perceptions self-existently, okay? Obviously he had all four of those perceptions. That's the whole point. He did see him getting, I'm sorry, he saw him getting his fingers cut off that he had had his whole life, and that him was the person who was going to be reborn. So obviously he saw all four things, but he didn't see any of them as existing independent of his projection. So it's something very interesting. What is he saying? If he's keeping his mind on the emptiness of the whole situation, then in a dependent origination sense, what is he thinking?
Because of my past karma I'm experiencing.
This is my dinchi, right? This is my projection. I'm projecting onto these events, and it's valid. It's valid in what sense? It's valid in the sense that there is blood spurting out, valid perception going on. There is a him. He is getting his fingers cut off. It's all going on. But he understood that it wasn't independent and that it depended on his what?
Projections
which were forced on him by his past karma. So the last thing he was going to do is blank the king.
Get angry
or hurt the king. His name, by the way, is Supamawa, the saint of patience. And the last thing he wants to do is have hatred for the king. And I think you see the Dalai Lama living this way, which is really cool. Maybe some kind of perception of emptiness behind it.
If this is too far off, just so let's say okay. It's too far off, but it reminds me very strongly of Arjuna Krishna, except in that one there's the realization, and then Krishna says, well, you take action anyway, and yet here the distinction is that he's not going to protect himself.
Oh, he didn't say, it's not a question of between of trying to avoid it or not trying to avoid it. It's whether you get hatred or not. Okay? That's a different question. Whether or not you try to prevent the guy from doing it, because he will collect bad karma. If you care about him, you might try to avoid it. And you might even take some forceful action against him that would hurt him less than the karma he's about to collect. But the whole point, they don't even mention that here. There's no mention of taking action or not taking action. It's just, did I feel hatred or not? Did I allow myself to feel hatred or not? That's all he says. He never says anything more. Okay. And then read the last part, George.
At that moment?
Yeah.
At that moment, I had no conception at all of any such conception that something was existing truly. At that same time, though, it was neither as if I had no other nominal conceptions at all. What Shibuti is saying here is the following. I did have the thought that I would have to keep my patience. I did have the thought to take the pain unwillingly and not to be upset about the harm being done to me. And I did have the kind of conception where I reconfirmed my knowledge of how I had perceived that no existing object had any true existence.
So it's interesting because at the end of the Diamond Cutter Sutra selection, he says, I didn't have all those conceptions. I didn't have any conceptions at all.
But it's not that I didn't have any conceptions, okay? So it means that he didn't have any conceptions of this whole incident or any one of the three parts of the incident not being his own projection. He didn't have any conception that anything going on was not a result of his own projection. In other words, he didn't take any of it to be self-existent or independently existing. He understood its dependent origination. And he didn't think anything else. So that's the conceptions he didn't have. What conceptions did he have? It mentions three. It mentions like, he had the thought that he had to keep his patience. And he had the thought that he should take the pain on willingly. Now, what does that just tell you?
It hurt.
It hurt him. He did have pain. And it's stated directly in the commentary. Okay? Stated directly. Okay? So if he does a person who has seen emptiness directly have pain as he gets his arms cut off? Yes, it does hurt him. But he wasn't upset. That's a big distinction. And that the whole essence of the path of habituation is there. What do you do with this grand perception of emptiness directly? You know, what are you going to use it for? Just that. When you get in that situation, first of all, that you will take the suffering on willingly. You understand where it's coming from. It's your own perception. You created that karma. And then secondly, you don't get upset and you don't allow yourself to have the feelings and the actions that will follow that. The only kind of upsetness, according to the Abhidhamma Kosha, which is acceptable, is of being upset about a bad deed that you did. You know, you can be upset that you collected that karma or feel regret. But everything else is a klesha. Yeah.
So this is like if you're being robbed by someone or, you know, tortured or what have you, rather than getting angry and looking at it as they doing something to you,
yep,
it's akin to just saying, I understand that this is my karma, I brought this about, I caused this, and now I'm experiencing.
It doesn't mean that you shouldn't avoid it. I'm not talking about what actions you take or
you
don't
take. No, I'm not talking about avoiding it.
But yeah, you must not hate that person.
While it's occurring.
You must not hate that person.
You realize your own responsibility in the situation that you brought to mind. You've actually created it as opposed to someone on the outside coming to you.
That's the whole point. And then if you understood its emptiness, you could not get angry. The perception of emptiness, the understanding of emptiness, and a klesha, a bad thought, are direct opposites mentally. You cannot entertain both at the same time. It's very interesting. One mind cannot hold those two mental functions at the same time. Period. That's why perceiving emptiness directly makes you an arhat. You cannot think this event is empty. You cannot understand its emptiness and at the same time have any klesha. They won't fit in your mind at the same time. They're opposites. They're nyambles. They are the ultimate antidote. It's cool. That's how you get rid of your bad thoughts.
Yeah,
and the only way.
One thing, this may be mundane, but the object of pain, there's so many mental techniques to avoid pain. I'm surprised that it has to experience it. I mean, is that his choice to be experienced?
Because mental techniques, if you... They don't work. They don't work all the time. We have them. Buddhism is full of them. You know, the Bodhisattva first 8 chapters, it's all about tricks to be a good person. Tricks not to be bad. And then the 9th chapter says, now I'll tell you how really not to be bad. You know, and Nagarjuna does the same thing in the letter to a friend. The whole first half of the book is tricks, how to fool yourself into being a good person, how to catch yourself when you're bad. And then at a certain point he says, but that won't work. And you got to see emptiness. And then that's his excuse, right, in the Nagarjuna, to talk about emptiness for the rest of the book. We're talking about ultimate antidotes and temporary fixes. Temporary fixes are necessary and great and wonderful, and you must do them. But they won't work ultimately. They might get you enough virtue to see emptiness and then get the ultimate fix. But it's the only antidote, and that's the whole point of wisdom. That's the whole point of perfection of wisdom. It's the only permanent antidote to pain. The others just break down at some point. There's nobody you can show me that I can't make them feel pain in about 30 seconds. It's a fact. It's a straight fact. You know, show me this great meditator, blah, blah, blah. You give me a razor blade or some pins and, you know, let's check. You know, it just doesn't work.
Apparently among highly realized virtuous beings as well. I mean, the point is, here's someone who's very close to being to the end of their road, and they're still experiencing very painful climb. Yeah,
it's just, you know it, in your heart, you know it doesn't work. If it did, we'd all figured it out by now. We wouldn't worry about learning dentist anymore. It wouldn't be such a big deal. Somebody would have written down how to do it, and you don't do it, and you'd be all right. You know, in your heart, you know it ain't a solution. Okay. Last thing. Let's see. Dr. Sykes. Did you do one already? Did you read anything?
No.
Okay. The bold part.
Okay.
Where it says, why is it so?
Why is it so? Suppose, Bosabuddhi, that at the moment any conception of a self had come into my mind, then he thought, to harm someone would have come into my mind as well.
Keep going.
The conception of some sentient being, and the conception of some living being, and the conception of
person
would have come into my mind. And because that, the thought to harm someone would have come into my mind as well.
Okay, so basically what he's saying is, if I had seen any self-existence in this situation, either of me or my fingers, or my life, or my lives, then I would have had anger, and I would have wanted to fight, hurt the person. There's a difference between fighting back and hurting the person. He would not have wanted to hurt the person. He might have resisted in order that the person not do a very bad deed. That's a different story. Not talking about that. Mainly, the klesha, nirvana is not defined as the elimination of all harmful acts. It's defined as the elimination of your bad thoughts. Out of great kindness, you might punch somebody sometimes. But that's a whole other story. He's just saying, I didn't get a harmful thought. If I had seen any self-existence at that moment, I would have had harmful thought. I would have had a thought to harm this person, to hurt this person.
So are you saying you can attain nirvana and still experience pain?
Looks like that. No, but I'm more referring... I wouldn't say that. I'd say that that you reach nirvana is the elimination of your mental affliction. It's not the elimination of your karma, your sakchiki pumbo. Your physical body created by your past karma and kleshas.
I mean, the senses are operating.
It must suffer. Its nature is that. Anything created by karma and mental afflictions must suffer.
So it's nirvana or something like that.
And that's a long story. Higher school has the people say things about that. Okay, I'll hand out the whole week. It's fine. Kathir, describe the emptiness of an arhat's mind. What do you think? I mean, this is really cool. When an arhat looks at his own mind, when an arhat is sitting and having a cup of tea quietly to himself before John Stillwell bangs on the door. I'm just kidding. I'm not an arhat.
But I did bang on the door.
If you're just having a quiet cup of tea after a long day, and you're just thinking about, you're aware of your own mind, you know, you're watching your own mind, you're thinking of your own mind. I mean, when an arhat sits down quietly and listens to his own mind, what is it? Is it empty or not? Not like our mind. When you take a quiz. Is his mind empty? Of course it is.
Yeah.
It's ultimate nature is that it's empty. But what is its relative nature? What is its dependent origination? What's its dependent origination? What's
thought?
Those last thought,
yeah. It's eliminated the causes.
No, I don't mean that. How does it exist? Dependently. What is its dependence? How does it exist in a relative way? Yeah. So it's interesting. You know, I'm not talking just about the guy at work, or New York City, or the condition of 39th Street. What about as you watch your own mind? Is that a projection also? Yeah. So he's collected a very interesting karma. His elimination of his own bad thoughts, his permanent ending of his own bad thoughts, is also a projection. It's a dependent origination.
Well, it's everything
that we do. Yeah. We didn't get to Buddha yet. We're only on path number 4, okay? We're only on Arhats. Last week we were on Aryas, okay? But it's interesting.
So we go back to where we're tricking ourselves into seeing things the way we want
to. Well, that's a long... No, no, I didn't say that. Not at all. But what I mean is, when an arhat enjoys the lack of mental afflictions in his own mind, that's also a projection. And it's a result of his having led a good life and understanding emptiness. Even as he's even as he focuses on his own lack of jealousy and anger and hatred and desire, he's just projecting that. By the way, there's a discussion in the reading, which is cool, you should read it, and I just want to give you a clue about it. Rather than... and it'll take 2 minutes. Does Laura Siegel of 1983 exist? Does Laura Siegel of 1983 exist? No, it's gone already. That's gone. That doesn't exist now. Let's say now.
Yeah.
Okay, Laura Siegel of 1983 doesn't exist now. Does Laura Siegel of 1997 exist now? Or I should say, Laura Siegel of the day after Buddhahood, which was predicted. Does it exist now? No. So really, there's only the very current moment of Laura Siegel. It's the only thing you can safely say exists now. Did Laura Siegel live in 1983?
Yeah.
Is Laura Siegel here now?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she lived in 1983. And Laura Siegel will be around on her mind. So what it means is, there's two ways of looking at her existence in the past and the future. If you pin her down to a point in time, okay, right now, does she exist in 1983? You know, does Laura Siegel of 1983 exist today? No. Okay. Has Laura Siegel been living since the day she was born? Yes. Does that include Laura Siegel 1983? Yes. So in that sense, Laura Siegel 1983 does exist. So what I mean to say is, just catch this. I mean, one way to label a person is to label her parts. Laura. Her physical form and her mind and her other parts. You can label those parts Laura. But along a timeline, you can do the same thing. You can say Laura Siegel, collectively, the Laurel Seal of 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, I can take all those indications and dinji them and call them Laura Siegel along a line of time. So in that sense as well, the act of prediction is a little tricky.
The act of prediction?
Yeah, the final prediction. See, I didn't come. I just want to leave it with this thought, okay? Because it comes in the reading and you might get confused. In the sense of, assuming she's not a Buddha now, which I don't know, does the Laura Siegel who is going to reach Buddhahood exist now? I'm sorry. Does Laura Siegel reaching Buddhahood exist now? No, it's a future thing. Does Laura Siegel of the... Let's say she got her prediction yesterday. Does that Laura Siegel exist now? Say yes. No.
Okay.
No. I mean, the Laura Siegel who, at the moment that she received the prediction, at 8:30, does she exist now?
No.
Say no. But there is a Laura Siegel, obviously, that we can label all those Laura Siegels that have been living in this life. We can call all of them together the life of Laura Siegel, right? That's Laura Siegel throughout her life, the current life. That's what we call general Laura Siegel. And that exists. So you have to think about that. It's not the point of... There's also a self-existence question there. What I'm saying is that the parts of a person not only mean the current legs, arms, head, mind. You can also name a person based on the stream of instants. And you can say John Stilwell's life. And that's another dependent originator.
But also, couldn't you do it too based on the continuum of your own consciousness?
In one school, that is the person.
Does that include imputing the future as well? Or the stream of life all the way
up to this point? No, all the way up to this point.
The whole thing.
Okay, give me homework.